It's the Confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin.
And I'm Megan Harris. The United States Army, National Guard, and Reserves together total just under 1 million soldiers, and filling their ranks requires a small army as well. President Trump has challenged the Department of Defense to build up our fighting forces, but many of our nation's young people just don't qualify. So what's holding them back? Major General Frank Muth took over the U.S. Army Recruiting Command at Fort Knox earlier this summer, and he came to Pittsburgh to find and inspire men and women to serve. General Muth, welcome to the Confluence.
Glad to be here.
General, if I did my math right, you've been in service for just over 30 years and seen combat at nearly every level. So what does it mean to you now to share your Army with would-be recruits?
Well, I think it really starts with my Army story. And that was when I was 16 and my brother came home from training. One, the way he looked in the uniform, but more specifically, all the things he shared with me of what he was doing in the Army. And I just found it very exciting. So from that point forward, I marched on the path to the Army and have been there for 32 years.
And the Military Times reported this year that only about 29% of youth ages 17 to 24 actually qualify for that military service. That's barely a quarter of the nation's young adults. So what's going on?
Well, it has to do, you know, there's several levels, but it's really on that physical side and a little bit on the aptitude and then also on the moral side. So those are the what typically start with reducing those numbers. And then, but within the 29%, there is a lower number, a much lower number, that has what we call the propensity to serve.
And when you say physical, you're talking about what?
Well, basically can pass the physical training test or the physical test that we have and also being overweight.
If a candidate is initially denied, can they try again, you know, seek mental health services or drop some weight?
They can. And matter of fact, our recruits, recruiters work with them when it comes to the physical side. We'll work with them both in some type of program to help them drop weight. And that's not unusual.
What about that propensity? What does that mean, you know, being able to serve?
Well, the propensity really is, do they want to serve? And so what we are finding is there's just less and less veterans. Well, let me back up. So 79% of the folks that we have in the Army actually have either a relative or a friend of a relative that serves. So they have the knowledge of the military. So as we start losing more and more veterans out there amongst the population, there's less people to provide awareness.
Yeah, I was about to say, I understand Pittsburgh is a particularly challenging market for recruits. Why is that?
Okay, so again, I go back to that national side of 29%, and it that does exist. But there's a percentage that have the propensity across the nation. For some, what we find in Pittsburgh, there's actually a lower propensity. And we think it's based on the amount of veterans that are in the area. It's just a lower number in Pittsburgh. Yet, I will tell you, the education level here is phenomenal. So what we have to do and what reasons we came is to, one, provide awareness about both what the Army is about and what we can offer. But then at the same time, we're not just about awareness, we're about recruiting and then being able to kind of close that deal and ask people to serve in the Army here out of Pittsburgh.
So give me the hard sell. Let's pretend I'm 10 years younger. Why would I want to serve in the U.S. Army?
Okay, so first of all, before we get into the benefits of the money, let's just talk about what are some of those intangibles that are out there. Selfless service, okay? Serving something that's kind of larger than just being about yourself. It's the work ethic, it's work experience, it's qualifications. If you came in on the cyber side, you would get at some point Cisco certified. It's a great way to transition out and have opportunities for employment later. It's development of leadership, qualifications, and developing maturity. Now, that is just on that kind of broader piece, but what are some of those harder things that we offer bonus-wise? Not just bonuses coming in, but education. So we have tuition assistance of about $6,000 a month while you're on active duty. But what, and I can give a great example, we do have a...
I can tell you've done this before.
No, this is actually my first interview while in command. But the GI Bill.
Recruited okay. A couple times, though.
Yes. The GI Bill, my daughter goes to Penn State main campus, by the way. Phenomenal institution. And so she is using the GI Bill right now that I earned, but I'm allowed to pass it to her. So when you honorably serve and you get out, you earn the GI Bill. And that is 4 years of a college paid for that you can pass to either your spouse or to your son or daughter. So my son used 2 years, and my daughter's using 2 years, and that saved us $90,000. So everybody that serves honorably and gets out of the military earns that.
I feel like a lot of what certainly my generation, probably your children as well, have seen of the U.S. Army, if you don't know someone who has served, is based on commercials. It's based on video games. It looks like snipers and infantry. But there are many other jobs that they can serve.
Oh, there's you know, all right, for example, biometric equipment specialist, human resource specialist, military police, engineers, you know, I mean, everything across the board. We have 150 different specialties that we train people on and that they operate. I'm a helicopter pilot by trade. And so I got to fly helicopters for 30 years. But then we have people that earn helicopter mechanic certification that transfer when you get out. And the same thing, ASC mechanics that work on vehicles. It transfers when you get out. Welding, technical type of, you know, electronics, avionics, across the board. There's a ton of different, like I said, 150 specialties that we train in.
I'm curious about some of those marketing efforts. I know in my own history and civics classes, they showed us, you know, that old Uncle Sam poster. And for a lot of us, that and the quiet recollections of parents or grandparents, that's really all we knew of military service. How do you translate, you know, some of those older images of the U.S. Army to what you're looking for today?
So we're into the me, or the, not me, but the millennials and the Z generation. And so what we've discovered, of course, they are out there on social media. And so what it is and what they're doing on social media. So we try to, now we're starting a brand new campaign in terms of our recruiting about getting into the social media, and whether it's on Facebook, Instagram, Snapchat, or on Twitter. And at the same time, we're actually standing up a esports team within the Army to go out and compete. And we're going to do an esports and an e-maneuver team. And, you know, right now, the Ultimate Fighter is, you know, that one of, we have a actual nationally ranked champion in the Army that's serving as a recruiter, and he goes out there and he's competing now. So we're going to stand up those teams to be able to talk to that audience and give them our story.
Even just in my lifetime, I remember there was the Be All You Can Be, Army Strong, an Army of One. Is there a fun new catchphrase for the Army that Snapchats?
So we actually call that a tagline, and the Army is working on it right now. So I know they're working on it, and I don't know when the rollout date is, but there is one coming very soon.
Is that a different challenge now, you know, especially for a generation that's so far removed from the last major domestic attack, 9/11?
I don't think so. I still think that, one, the Army offers a unique opportunity to everybody, no matter which generation we're trying to approach. And so if you talk about the benefits, and you talk about not just benefits of serving and kind of giving back and the selfless service piece, but it's also about what we provide training-wise in the service and then afterwards, too. If you don't feel that you want to stay in the military and make it a career, there's opportunities either way. And it's not just the regular Army. We also have the Reserve and the National Guard out there. So if you don't want to leave your hometown, there's Reserve units here in Pittsburgh, matter of fact, that if you wanted to come out and get qualified in your MOS, but come back home and serve one weekend out of the month and 2 weeks during the summer, you can do that.
Is it possible that young people who maybe grew up with a family member or an older sibling, a cousin, maybe a parent that served and came home with mental or physical challenges, there seems to be a lot more honesty about those challenges now, but could that honesty maybe be concerning for a young person considering a career in the armed forces?
I'm sure it is, and that somebody would always think about that. But I will tell you that you can see that the different institutions that are out there that are addressing these issues and helping the veterans deal with what they've experienced and deal with what the problems they have and help them continue on, whether they're continuing to serve because there's folks still serving and there's others that have elected to get out, but to help them through that transition.
So what could help you, an Army recruiter, more easily help us, the American populace that presumably needs protection?
To help me? Well, I mean, really, it's to get the story out, and it's to talk about what the Army offers and what we do defending our nation and what we provide the youth today if they elect to join. And I would ask you, come in, take a look what we have to offer, and, you know, and if that's the way of life or that's what you want to try to join and become part of, because, again, it's something bigger than ourselves. You know, we offer a lot of opportunities, not just in the military, but what happens if you elect not to stay in and you want to get out? That's great. But, you know, you're taking with you the experience, the leadership, the maturity, and in many cases, qualifications that will allow for you to get out and find a job.
Major General Frank Muth is the Commander General of the U.S. Army Recruiting Command at Fort Knox. General, thanks so much for being on the Confluence.
It is my honor and pleasure. Thank you, Megan.
I'm Megan Harris. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
It's The Confluence, where the news comes together. I'm Kevin Gavin. Deer. They can put themselves in danger when they wander onto a busy roadway. But an always fatal danger to deer and elk is chronic wasting disease. The Pennsylvania Game Commission is still battling to try to stop the spread of the disease. We're going to talk about that with John Hayes, outdoors editor for the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. John, welcome back to the program.
Good to be here.
John, I understand that CWD, chronic wasting disease, was first detected in Pennsylvania about 6 years ago. Really, briefly, what is it? How's it spread?
It's a brain disease caused by prions, which are malformed proteins. Interestingly, it's not a virus or a bacteria. It's a protein. It's not alive. It's a protein that is malformed, and when it touches other proteins, it causes them to be malformed also. Mm-hmm. It's very similar to mad cow disease.
Okay. So it was first detected in captive deer, but yeah. Then it did spread to free-ranging deer.
Yeah, that's a big debate. I forget what they're called, the Association of Deer Farms. Mm-hmm. They claim that the wild deer are infecting their herds. And, of course, the Game Commission says, well, we have evidence that, you know,
the deer farms,
that's where it's coming from. And it's, you know, once it's in the ground, it's spread by bodily fluids.
Right.
So once it gets in the ground, they don't know how long this stuff lasts. It can last for 20 years or more. That means that 20 years from now, a deer licks some dust or something and could get this disease. This is a national concern, not just in Pennsylvania. It's all over the country, and it's really serious. And here's why: deer are a keystone species, like beavers. They impact every other animal around them. But the deer eat. If you like to take a hike and you see birds on the tree will never be there if the deer eat it when it's a nub. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. They eat the grass that other animals use as habitat. They eat everything, and so they impact everything. So, you know, if you take away the deer, nobody's sure how that's going to impact everything else. Hmm. It's a real serious issue, and it's getting worse in Pennsylvania. Since last year at this time, the Game Commission set up a new disease management area.
What is that exactly? We have a few of them now in the state.
There's four of them now. Well, there's three of them. One of them was closed, so there's three of them. But a deer management area is an area where they've confirmed CWD, and there are special regulations on importing and exporting deer parts from those areas. Hunters, you shoot a deer anywhere in this area, you can't take it out.
So you get it processed there?
You get it processed there. I mean, who would want to hunt in a deer management area anyway? Exactly. So I don't think there's a whole lot of that. But it's really important for the deer farm industry, because if their farm is within one of these areas, they can't sell their deer. Mm. That's their business. They raise deer and they sell them. When you go to a fancy restaurant and they sell venison, that's where it comes from. And they can't do that. It's a big deal for them.
You mentioned that the protein can sort of stay active in soil or wherever for years. They don't actually even know how long. So efforts to actually stop the spread, are they failing?
Or yeah, what? Failing big time all over the country. I read a study or a report on a study where they intentionally put deer with chronic wasting disease in an area, and then they burned the entire area. Then they took bulldozers and scraped the topsoil off. Years later, deer got chronic wasting disease there. They don't even know how that could happen. They know so little about this, and it's spreading so fast, and the potential is so large for it to be a really big thing.
Is CWD transmittable to humans, especially if they eat the venison?
The Centers for Disease Control say no. No human has ever been confirmed to have it. However, the most recent study that I saw was that consuming venison that had CWD in it. I don't know if you could actually get CWD, but you got a first step towards CWD. And even that's not confirmed yet, but that's really serious. Because you don't know. You cannot tell from a living deer whether it has it or not. The last stage, they become very sickly, weak, looking for water, obviously sick. But for the first stages of the deer, for months, you can't tell until you kill it and examine its brain.
Final question on this. Early archery season is upon us. What's the overall impact of CWD on hunters?
Well, if you're in those counties with a disease management zone, which are Lancaster, Lebanon, Berks, Juniata, Mifflin, Perry, Adams, Bedford, Blair, Cambria, Clearfield, Cumberland, Franklin, Fulton, Huntington, Somerset. If you're hunting in those within a deer management area, it's definitely going to impact you because you can't take your deer out. If you're hunting in those counties, you might want to be careful because it is in the wild. And, you know, who knows, you know, whether your deer has it or not until you kill it and then have it tested. If you're in Allegheny County, Westmoreland, if you're a archery hunter in this area, probably within the range of this broadcast, it hasn't been confirmed in this area.
John Hayes is the outdoors editor for the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. John, thanks so much.
Sure.
I'm Megan Harris. Still ahead on The Confluence, this year's Heinz Award winners include Sherry Mason, whose work on microplastics contributed to a ban on small plastic beads in body washes and shampoos. She explains her research and what she'd like to see next in corporate responsibility. Residents and analysts aren't sure who will fill the latest luxury housing development proposed for the former site of the Bloomfield neighborhood's only grocery store. And longtime county elections manager Mike Walasik bids adieu to the electoral process. Those stories, conversations, and more when The Confluence continues on 90.5 WESA.
Picture this. You're in the most popular rock and roll band of your generation. You have fame, money, fans, and notoriety to boot. The only problem? You never wanted it in the first place. That's where Nirvana found themselves after their breakthrough album Nevermind catapulted them into the mainstream world they were rebelling against. The band's answer to all the outside pressure for another hit-laden record was, of course, their most raw and aggressive collection of songs to date. The plan backfired. To date, In Utero has sold over 15 million copies. Nirvana's final studio album turns 25 tomorrow. For 91.3 WYEP, I'm Joey Spihar.
It's The Confluence. I'm Kevin Gavin. The site of the Bloomfield Shore Save IGA, the only full-service grocer in their neighborhood, could soon be home to another luxury apartment complex. But residents and analysts aren't sure who will fill this proposed complex, since luxury apartment buildings average 30% vacancy in Pittsburgh. 90.5 WESA's Avery Keatley reports.
In late 2017, Millhouse Development announced it wanted to buy the property on Liberty Avenue and build a high-end apartment complex. But that plan has many residents worried about what a luxury apartment building could do to their own rents.
There are a lot of people who can no longer afford the rents, and most of them are not able to find other apartments they can't afford in Bloomfield right now.
That's Christina Howell with the Bloomfield Development Corporation. She helped organize a community meeting in January where Millhouse unveiled its proposal to the public.
But I also have a major concern with the cost of the units that you're...
The meeting hall was packed and people were emotional. The crowd even cheered as Millhouse developer Thomas Bose fielded question after question about not just the demolition of the grocery store, but the rising cost of rent.
So my first question is, what are the prices going to be and how do you expect to fill this property?
So the rents here at 4401 Liberty Avenue, we're planning to start at $1,000 and go up to $2,500. But we understand that this is an issue that's not just with Bloomfield, but Pittsburgh in general.
Bose declined an interview for this story, and that night he didn't address how the company expects to fill the new complex. Over the last year and a half, 16 multifamily apartment buildings opened across Pittsburgh. According to a report from CoStar Analytics, at the beginning of this year, these buildings had a 40% vacancy rate. Now that's down to 30%, according to Shayna Callahan, CoStar's Pittsburgh market analyst.
It's a possibility that there's overbuilding. There's also a lot of old aged multifamily properties as well as old office properties that are being renovated and converted into multifamily. So that's adding to the supply. Demand kind of needs time to catch up.
By comparison, older apartment buildings average just 4% vacancy, according to the report. But that hasn't stopped developers from buying up sites and breaking ground. An estimated 2,500 units are currently under construction across the city. And that has some residents fearing the era of affordable rents is coming to a close. Callahan studies housing markets across the region. She says Pittsburghers should be worried.
If investors and landlords are seeing that there are people driven to this new property, I'm sure they will raise rents. I've seen it happen in other metros in Pittsburgh and in some of the other areas I cover.
Miles Dinan rented and worked in and around Bloomfield for about a decade in the early 2000s. Dinan doesn't own a car and says walking to food, entertainment, and friends was one of the main draws of the neighborhood. Back then, living there wasn't so expensive.
I rented a few places there, and none of them were over $500 a month. And sometimes that included utilities.
In 2011, Dinan looked to buy a house in Bloomfield, but couldn't afford one. Instead, they purchased a home in Millvale. Christina Howe of the Bloomfield Development Corporation says she wonders, with continued construction of new luxury apartments, stories like Dinan's could become more common.
With all of these apartment buildings coming online at about the same time in the East End, and it seems that their vacancy rates are fairly high right now. What does that mean for the ones that are being proposed in neighborhoods like ours?
8 months after that community meeting, Bloomfield residents are still waiting for an answer. I'm Avery Keatley, 90.5 WESA News.
You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. It's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin.
And I'm Liz Reed. Microbeads, those little plastic beads you used to see in body wash and toothpaste, have been banned in the United States since last summer. Sherry Mason is one of the researchers responsible for that ban. She was the first to identify microbeads and microfibers in the world's largest freshwater system, the Great Lakes. She's one of the recipients of this year's Heinz Awards, and she joins us now. Sherry Mason, thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Start by explaining, what are microbeads and microfibers?
Well, both of these belong to kind of a bigger category, which is microplastics. So these are particles that are less than 1 millimeter in size, little pieces of plastic. In the case of microfibers, they come off of our clothes when we wash them. In the case of microbeads, as you pointed out, they were added to certain personal care products, face washes, body washes, toothpastes, with the intent of acting as an abrasive. Plastic is a really kind of unique material in multiple ways, but one of those is the fact that it doesn't biodegrade the way that natural materials do. So as the plastics kind of get broken up and become smaller and smaller and smaller, they still retain their properties. And that is the concern when it comes to microplastics.
How widespread are they in the water supply?
Really kind of every environmental compartment in the world that we've looked in. And we've gone to remote lakes in the middle of Mongolia, and we still find microplastics. They're just everywhere.
So why is it dangerous to have them in the water supply?
Well, I think, you know, probably a lot of us have maybe heard news of reports of large pieces of plastic and the impact that they have on aquatic organisms, right? So most recently, you hear a lot about like sperm whales beaching themselves and being euthanized, and their stomachs are filled with plastic bags. The concern with microplastics is a little bit different than that. We're not really concerned about the direct effects, that is an organism eating them and then dying as a result of that. We're more concerned about an indirect effect, and that is that when we manufacture plastics, we embed a lot of chemicals into them. These are plasticizers that make the plastics moldable, this UV stabilizers that help protect them from the damaging rays of sunlight, colorants, flame retardants. You know, there's just a kind of a plethora of chemicals that are embedded within them. And In addition to that, when plastics are out and in the external environment, they pick up chemicals, things like PCBs, polychlorinated biphenols, that were used as industrial insulators in the 1970s and were banned because of the known human health impacts. Polyaromatic hydrocarbons is another group of compounds that we found on microplastics that we've pulled out of the Great Lakes, and these come most notably from combustion processes like coal-fired power plants. And so you have all these chemicals in and on the plastics, and when the plastics are ingested, they then move those chemicals into the food supply and up the food supply ultimately into us. And as I kind of pointed out, many of these chemicals have known human health impacts. They're most notably endocrine disruptors. That means that they mimic hormones and can lead to a wide variety of impacts as a result of that.
So you talked about them getting into the food supply ingested by smaller animals and then larger animals and up the food chain. Do they also just end up in the water from our tap?
Yeah, actually, our research group last year published two pretty impactful studies, one looking at tap water, and then kind of as a result of tap water, another study looking at bottled water. And we found in both cases that there are microplastics within both tap and bottled water. Bottled water has considerably more than tap water, and within bottled water, it seems that they're really kind of originating from the act of packaging the water. That is the plastics that we found came that were associated with the caps and the bottles, and a significant portion of them had industrial lubricants on them. So it was actually the act of packaging the water that led to the plastic pollution within the water itself.
So I want to go back to this idea of endocrine disruptors that you brought up, and these are chemicals that disrupt the normal hormonal processes in our bodies, right?
Correct.
And I actually read an article in GQ recently, you may have read this, that was about decreasing fertility in men, and endocrine disruptors are believed to be responsible for that. So, I mean, are there potential long-term consequences to having these chemicals in our water, in our environment, in our bodies that we're not even considering?
Oh, absolutely. And sadly, this is one of the issues of science, is that, you know, scientists tend to do their work in their labs and they publish in peer-reviewed journal articles, and the mass public isn't reading these kind of articles. And so this stuff has been, you know, pretty well documented over the past couple of decades, but is now just kind of slowly making its way kind of more into the public consciousness. And it's, you know, from the standpoint of somebody who studies this, it's really scary. And I watch something like, you know, The Handmaid's Tale, and it's not that far gone. You know, we're kind of on the path of that.
For people who don't watch The Handmaid's Tale, the premise is that there's this epidemic of infertility, right, that leads to this, like, brutally patriarchal society.
Correct. Yeah, exactly. And that is kind of where we're leading to. You know, these chemicals are known to have impacts on both men and female. For women, you know, it's leads to earlier onset of puberty, which later in life is kind of associated with breast cancer, ovarian cancer. And for men, what we see is this kind of increased feminization of the male species. And so that's associated with lower sperm counts. And that leads to kind of increased concern with regard to the ability of our species to procreate.
So it's not all bad news, though, that we have seen some policy change as a result of this work, right?
Correct. And more to come, I think. You know, as a result of our tap and bottled water study, the World Health Organization has called for a human impact study to be done. And we really need that kind of science happening and becoming, you know, more public in order to create these bigger societal changes. So I look forward to kind of where we go from here. And you know, I don't think that the news is all dire. I think that, you know, we're hopefully kind of becoming aware of this early enough in the process that we can really kind of change our society and minimize kind of the impacts that this has on future generations.
I mean, what policy changes would you like to see in the future?
I mean, I think the biggest thing for me is extended corporate responsibility. So if industry is going to manufacture particular goods, they need to be responsible for making sure that those goods get disposed of properly. And this is kind of most often thought of with regard to electronics, right? So at least where I live in New York State, you know, any electronic item can be returned to any place where those are sold, regardless of whether or not you bought them there, so that they can be recycled properly. And the intent of that is all the heavy metals that are associated with electronic goods and making sure that those don't end up in the external environment. And I'd like to see things like that with associated with plastics as well, in terms of, you know, the bags, the bottles, the straws, and so that those kind of disposable plastics don't end up being released into the external environment, and all the kind of associated effects that that can have on you know, all organisms, and including us. So
what can regular folks do to address this problem?
I think the biggest thing is to start by looking at yourself and your own life, and does plastic make its way into your life, and is there a way that you can reduce your use of plastic? You always have to start with yourself, right? It's really easy to point your fingers at other people, but if you're not willing to make the changes, then you can't expect other people to as well.
Sherry Mason, thank you so much for speaking with us today.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
Sherry Mason is a professor of chemistry and chair of the Department of Geology and Environmental Science at the State University of New York in Fredonia. She's one of six winners of this year's Heinz Awards, and she spoke with 90.5 WESA's Liz Reed. It's The Confluence. I'm Kevin Gavin. Mark Wallasek has headed Allegheny County's elections office since 1991, overseeing every political contest here for more than a quarter century. But he retired this month, ending a career that began with a part-time job loading voting machines in 1970. He spoke this week with WESA's Chris Potter about voting security, the steady decline in voter turnout, and the unprecedented political dramas of his last year in office.
We had four elections this year. So, that was having two elections 1 week apart. I don't think anyone has ever done that.
Right. You're referring to the special elections in there were a couple of state legislative races. And then, of course, the very famous
The 18th Congressional,
District, yes. A special election between Rick Saccone and Connor Lamb. I wanted to ask you about that because as I and other reporters were at the election night parties there, we saw you as big as life on this widescreen TV on CNN. Had you ever had that kind of national attention before? And did you want it?
It was a little intimidating after the first interview, and I said, wow, the whole country can see this. He said, the whole world can see this. So that was a little, and Tim, but you don't think
about it. Made you feel
that.
Better, did it? Made you feel more at ease?
Yeah. I mean, you know, you're into what you're doing, and, you know, you go on autopilot after this many years. I'm not saying it's easy, but, I mean, you're used to it.
Talk a little, because one of the things you were sort of known for was the pre-election turnout forecasts here. What do you make of this sort of declining interest in elections, even as so much of the controversy about elections continues? And I want to ask you about some of those.
If you look at the turnout from the 60s, in some presidential elections, it was close to 90%, which is, I can't imagine working on an election day when you had a 90% turnout. I think it was you had the local party structure, your county committee people were the people that hectored people to go out to vote and say, hey, we're going to see you on election day. Little by little, that just goes by the wayside. And so it's just not a criticism. I think it's just the fact that the local committee and the personal touch of your committee man or woman, you don't have that anymore.
On the other side of the political spectrum, there are people who are concerned about election security because, and these tend to be, I think, from the right, who are worried about non-citizens coming in and voting in our elections. Or, you know, you hear these kind of apocryphal stories of a busload of people brought in from out of state or whatever, that kind of stuff. In all the elections that we've had, you never saw a case where somebody came in or bussed people in or did any of this kind of stuff to try to change the outcome in a concerted effort to change the outcome of elections.
No.
Can you kind of put a ballpark number on how many cases you've had where somebody cast a ballot who should not have been allowed to do so?
We had about 80 or 90 cases of people that were registered to vote, and when they applied for citizenship, that's when they realized, or immigration realized, you know, I would think they asked the questions, are you registered or have you ever voted? And there were people that did that. So they come to our office and they canceled their voter registration and we verified it. I think there was a case of a woman who voted 35 times.
In Allegheny County.
Yeah, more than probably most people that are citizens and had a really great voting record. But she never knew. And then when she found out, she self-reported herself and canceled it. We had a case that there was someone who was in the military. He was in the military, was not a citizen, One would think that easily you could think that you'd be qualified to register to vote. So some of these people voted a few times. Some didn't vote at all, but they were self-reported.
And that's that you said that was 80 to 90 cases of
yes.
that. And that's in the course of what time frame, like all 48 years of your tenure?
Oh, probably since the early 2000s is when we started seeing people come up to do that. Maybe they didn't ask the questions before. It's just something that you never thought about. And you never have to prove you're a citizen when you're registered to vote. You sign an affidavit or a declaration saying that, I'm 18 years old, I'm a United States citizen.
And this is exactly the Republican or the conservative complaint about that process. Do you think that should be changed at all?
No. I mean, even when you had to register to vote in person, which up until 76, that's what you had to do. You never had to produce any kind of ID to prove you're a citizen. I was asked for picture ID two times because my signature didn't match. So.
Why is that?
Well, because you registered to vote in 1971, and you get to the point where I've signed so many documents in my life that you learn to sign your name as quickly as you can, and it didn't bear a resemblance. And I'm the elections division manager, and I got carded two times on election day, and it wasn't done on purpose. No one knew who I was. So people do their jobs, whether people think they don't or not, they do.
Looking ahead, if you could change something about the way elections were conducted here in Allegheny County in Pennsylvania, what would that be? And what do you think kind of the biggest hurdle elections officials are facing going forward?
I mean, I really think that, the idea of voting in person it's starting to become unworkable because you cannot find people that wanted to vote the time to do this. We're really grateful to people that do it. This is not a criticism of anybody. People say, wait a minute, that's like a 15-hour day. I can't devote 15 hours to do this. I'd love to do it. People just do not have the time to do it anymore.
Are you going to do it? You're retired now. Are you going to?
No. After 50 years, I've gone through enough elections. Pennsylvania is one of the few states where some of your polling place officials are actually publicly elected. They're nominated at the primary. They're elected in November. You look at some elections from the 70s, almost every precinct had three people running for those seats. And in some cases, there was actually contested elections for judge of election. You had a whole local army of political workers that you don't have anymore.
Any election result that surprised the hell out of you?
No, I think because we do it for a living, we talk about it less than almost anybody I know about because we're so intent on the mechanics of it, we don't care about the politics of it. We really don't even talk about it. And by 2 weeks before Election Day, we can't wait for the day to come because we're just like so tired of it.
Raises one of those questions, too, which is heavily Democratic county. Certainly many times I've heard Republicans sort of, cast dark aspersions as to how things really got run around here because this is a Democratic, Democratic stronghold here. What do you want those folks to know if anybody thinks that there are shenanigans afoot?
In 95, it was Larry Dunn and Bob Cramner got elected a Republican majority for the Board of Commissioners. Jim Roddy was elected first chief county executive. It was funny, when there was Democrats controlled the courthouse, you would hear, I bet if I was a Democrat, you wouldn't have thrown that voter registration away, which we didn't. And then when it flipped, then we hear, I bet if I was a Republican, you wouldn't have thrown it away. So I guess, we're crooked in a bipartisan way.
What are you going to do on election day this year? Are you just going to go around to the polls and heckle people? Or how will you be spending that day?
No, well, what day is that? That's a Tuesday. We'll go to the gym, and then when we come back, then I'll probably go vote late morning.
You'll probably go vote.
Well, yeah. Okay. I'll probably vote late morning.
You ever missed a vote yourself?
No.
WESA's politics and government accountability editor, Chris Potter, speaking with longtime and now retired county elections manager, Mark Wallasek. And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA.
On our next program, are companies, major nonprofits buying into a $4 billion 12-year initiative to address affordable housing, infrastructure, universal pre-K, and transportation challenges in the Pittsburgh area? We'll get an update from Mayor Bill Peduto. The Pittsburgh International Festival First is back with performances and exhibits from 20 countries. And we're going to go climbing with one of the world's most famous professionals as Pittsburgh gears up for its first ever professional climbing competition. Today's program was engineered and produced by Kylie Kaczynski, production assistance from Mick Stinelli. The producer of The Confluence is Megan Harris. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good day of good news.